back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am once again joined by some of my friends from CGS. Something we always talk about doing, we say, we're going to do this at least every 6 months. We never get it done again in less than a year. It never happens. We have Chris Eberle with us. Chris, this has got to be like the fifth or sixth time on the show, right?
I'd say so, Paul, and I'm, as always, happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
I'm always happy to have you on, but this is the very first time that I'm managing to get Shane Mulholland on with us.
Yay.
Thanks for coming on, Shane.
Oh,
it isn't
for
our first time recording together, because I did manage to squeeze in a visit at CBS a couple of months ago. So it's cool to return, either return the favor or have you return the favor or whatever it may be. I don't even
know.
But thanks for coming on. I was looking forward to having you guys. We're going to split this up in two, though, because Ian Levenstein and Adam Murdo were supposed to come on as well. But schedules just did not line up. So rather than just keep putting it off, we decided, you know what, we'll split it into two shows. And, you know, like I had said, that when we do that, if you guys are available, you're more than happy to join it. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. But that said, Chris and I were talking before we started to record about that I've been going a little nuts lately, and I've been spending a lot more money on old comics than I used to or that I should. But thankfully, my wife is an enabler, as I've said many times on this show, and she doesn't get mad at me when I come home and say, "Yeah, I spent a couple hundred dollars."
Yeah.
So anyway, I've been going crazy buying. The biggest thing that I've been getting, or the thing I'm happiest at, Chris, I've gotten, I think, 4 or 5 issues of Amazing Spider-Man below issue 40, less than $40.
Wow.
So it's been a long time since I was able to fill one of those holes in that collection.
Yeah.
You know, I was telling Chris, I only go up to issue 300 is my top number. I don't go beyond that because I have to limit myself somewhere. I had a solid run from issue 48 up. But below that, I probably have about 15 of the 47 issues. So it gives me a lot that I need. And just to be filling in 4 or 5 spots, really,
that's amazing.
Makes me happy.
Well, yeah. Paul, if you accept Blue Low Grade, you'll be able to get most of those issues.
Now, I was at a show a couple of months ago. They're having a show once a month over in Melville, New York, which is only 10 minutes from my house. And it's purely a comic show. There's no entertainment stuff. It's just back issues, no creators. And I found a dealer who had, you know, decent amount of older stuff, and most of the things were in a box for $20 a book, and you know, it was quality stuff. But then when you went further, they had a divider that said, you know, $100 past this divider. And I was looking through there, and you know, it's harder for me to justify paying $100 a book. But I saw a copy of Spider-Man, I would say 15, the first Mysterio.
Nice.
And I pulled that out for $100 on buy, and it was in nice shape. And I handed it to him, and he was like, "You know, this wasn't over here." He puts it in $20. I said, "Oh, no, no." And he says, "Okay, let's go look at it." He says, "It's $500. And I said, I thought it was $100. He says, no. He says, "From here to here was $100. Everything beyond that is we tell you the price when you pull it out."
Did he have a sign? I have to speak as an old retailer now. Did he have a sign indicating that?
He had a divider, but the divider was not clear as to what it said.
Yeah, that's crappy retailing.
Yeah.
So I kind of give him the credit for actually having separated from the $100 books, but not having it marked as to what it is. I just thought everything past that $100 mark was $100.
Sure.
I'm gonna. This is just, you know, both as a customer and then all the years I was selling books, anyone who doesn't have price tags in their books, I walk away immediately. Walk away. Because to me, that's just shady right off the bat.
The worst stores that I've dealt with, and there's only a handful of them that I've dealt with, and I will only go to stores that do this once, because once I walk out, I never come back, is the ones that don't have anything marked, and then you walk up to the register and they pull out a price card.
No, yeah. No.
First of all, I don't pay price by prices for anything.
Yeah, that's too fluid. No way.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, not to be too cynical, but you know, in some cases, they may be assuming that the potential buyer doesn't have the knowledge necessary to know whether or not they're being ripped off.
Yeah.
Because, you know, color me crazy, but some comic book dealers are kind of slimy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like any other business. You're going to give people respect and people you can.
Yeah. Well, yeah. In that business, there's a preponderance of people that, you know, you should be very wary of.
Yeah.
So the Simpsons guy exists for a reason.
Paul, your Spider-Man collection sounds like my Justice League collection. I have from the most recent issue before they stopped making them for now, all the way back to, gosh, it's got to be like in the 50s of the original series and everything front. And then from that point down to one, I have some sporadic ones. I think the lowest one I have is like 14 or 13. And I'm missing, I think, like 35 issues total from number one to whatever that number is that I have the complete run then. And I don't, of course, I don't have Brave and the Bold 3 issues. I don't have those at all. But I have the DC archives. Yeah, yeah. I have the archives, so that encompasses everything that I am missing. So in that sense, I do have a complete readable run. But the issues themselves, I'm missing probably like 30, 35 issues.
Now, Justice League was never my go-to. I've always loved the Justice League. It was never my go-to as far as collecting. I was always more of a Marvel guy. But I've recently, and I'm talking within the last 6 months, added some issues without breaking the bank on any of them. I've added issues 19, 20, 24, and 35.
So, nice.
You know, and that's awesome. I don't think I spent more than $15 for any of them.
That's fantastic.
You know, when I can find them like that, so, you know, I can't help myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't want to go beyond our time crunch because I know at some point you guys are going to say, enough, let me go. So we are going with a normal format, Marvel or DC and an indie. But as the guests, my tradition is I always let the guests pick what order we go. You want to go first the time, you want to go last the time, I don't care.
Doesn't matter to me.
Any preference, Chris?
I think we should start with ElfQuest because I'm excited to talk about that book.
Okay, so I'm going to give a little ElfQuest history for you, or at least my ElfQuest history.
Please do.
Back in the late 70s, because I am older than dirt, was when I first got my driver's license. And my mom would go to a place where her sisters were, where they worked, actually, in Bay Ridge, New York. I lived in Marine Park, New York. She would go in Bay Ridge, which is about half an hour away, on the weekends, like on a Saturday during the day, she'd go spend time with her sisters. And a lot of times, so that I could use the car, I'd drop her off, I'd have the car for the day, and then I'd pick her up at the end of the day. And those were the opportunities where I would stop by this one store in Bay Ridge where they had different things from the comic book stores that were in my neighborhood. And that's where I discovered ElfQuest. And it was the only store I ever saw ElfQuest in those days. And the listeners can't appreciate the video, but I have the original run. I have about 10 issues of it. And they went for $1.25 each, so they were very expensive.
Yeah.
And I thought the series was just awesome back then. And it had a real, like, Lord of the Rings feel to it. And I remember being very into it. It's funny because I haven't broken these out in forever. But I, even in 81 or 82, I bought the ElfQuest Gathering. And I really was into it. Then when Facebook started, I became friends on Facebook with Wendy and Richard Peeney.
Get out.
I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
Except that they kept posting political things. Now, I don't care if I agree with you or don't agree with you on your political stuff. I don't really want to see it on Facebook, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And somebody actually called them out and said, you know, you have to post so much political stuff. And I don't even remember. I don't remember if they were uber liberal or uber conservative. It doesn't matter. But they just kind of gave the theoretical middle finger to that person and said, if you don't like it, unfriend us. And I just took the bull by the horns, and I understand it. I was not the one who called them out on it, but I just thought that was so callous to just say, oh, I don't care, I'm posting my political stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but I, be that as it may, I still am to this day very, very impressed with what they did with the series, because they just pretty much did this all on their own in the beginning. And if you look at this issue, some of it is clearly done like on an old typewriter in the
the
text pages.
Now it's part of the charm of it. I loved it.
It is part of the charm. I agree. But you know, it takes a lot of initiative and a lot of guts to self-publish this. Excuse me, this stuff. Especially at that time.
Oh yeah, what was it, 1978? I think I read.
Yeah. So it's very, very impressive, actually. And the work, you know, the work is beautiful. So I think the stories, I don't remember all the details of the stories. And I even though, like I said, I bought the Old Quest Gathering and I read it, but I really don't remember the details about what they gave us. And when it, by the time it got reprinted by Marvel, and they added color to the issues and everything, I was in a stretch when I wasn't collecting it, so I didn't really get into those. But to give a brief synopsis, the story is written and drawn. Actually, in the Marvel comic, they give all the credit to Wendy Pini, but in this one, they say Wendy and Richard. So I'm pretty sure it's Wendy and Richard. Anyway, we start off with a group of humans in this world who are having a ceremony where they're going to sacrifice an elf. And then we get a quick history of the elves and the humans and their basically antagonistic way to each other. And then we join our hero in current days where they rescue the elf that's about to be sacrificed. They fight off the humans. They actually kill one of them. So it is not totally a children's story. They return to their village. But in the meanwhile, the humans are more and more outraged over the fact that one of their people died. Then we come back to the village where they're licking their own wounds. But then, we get a lot of parts where we're just kind of meeting the different characters. And you know, that's one part where the exposition is almost a little bit more basic. Because, you know, there's pictures of the characters with their names next to them and that type of thing.
Yeah.
But then eventually, you know, you find out that this is the elf tribe are wolf riders. So they have the wolves on their side, effectively, and they can communicate with them. And then the humans come to attack them to get their revenge. And what they do is they set the elves' camp on fire. So the elves have to flee. And what they do is they go to the area where the gnomes are. And within the gnomes, they're not welcome either, or by the gnomes, they're not welcome. But they make their way in and they try to bargain with them. The elves are clearly our heroes in these stories. They get before the gnome king, who is not happy with them. But anyway, they finally convince him to take them through and let them out where there's an area that's sunny that isn't on fire at the threat of his life. So he sends off his minion, who they have beaten down, to lead them. He takes them out, and then as soon as he takes them out, he causes an avalanche that won't let them back into their caves, and they're looking at the sun and not knowing where to go, and that's where the story ends. And then we get a little extra added page, or a few extra added pages on here, where they kind of show you the evolution of how the characters were originally drawn and how they built them up. And then we get a color picture of Cutter, who's one of the main characters. And it's just a nicely put together book. And it is, according to their piece in here, it is the second printing of this particular story, that they had one that was even more rudimentary that had come out, I guess, about a year earlier. And then they upgraded their printing process, and I think these issues honestly are fine. I don't know if you guys have run into them, Chris. I don't know if they ever came into your store.
ElfQuest would pop up, back would come in every once in a while, not often.
The magazine sized ones.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were they a hot item to sell?
No, I don't recall having any real people asking for them or any real demand for them.
That's a shame. That's a shame. I just recently looked on eBay just to see, oh, do I have something here that I didn't even know had value? And it didn't look like they were going for high prices. But to me, it's a forgotten treasure. I really enjoyed these issues when they were coming out, and you know, going back into it and rereading this one was kind of fun. And I think I may try and, since old age has robbed me of my memories of most of what went on in these books, it's like they're brand new for me.
Yeah.
So, well, Paul, what I love about you selecting this is that when he was still with us, Jamie D, for one of our episodes, he was always a fan of ElfQuest, and we did a review, and the book we chose was not the first issue like this. It was well into the series. Remember the Shane?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah, I do.
So
I'm surprised I missed that.
Yeah, this is years ago, and the rest of us just weren't that taken with it because we didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah, I think it was the beginning of a story, but a much later iteration
and
of it.
And what was great about this was that I got to revisit the concept because as Jamie was a proponent of it, but from the beginning, and I enjoyed it far more than the whatever one we read.
Yeah, I do too.
So,
and they did a great job of really introducing everybody in a kind of forgotten way that I don't think many people do these days when they introduce characters. A little bit of a primer, you get a little bit of name tag with the character, and it was just well done. It was kind of, you know, to lack of a way to sound old, it was vintage, classic way of storytelling.
Well, for me, what was really affected me was the artwork is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, right out of the gate, they're producing superb fantasy artwork. Has this been animated yet? Because it screams for that.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah, it really does.
I mean, right, going back to this from the late 70s, these first appearances, I mean, the stylized fantasy lines, the and I mean this in the best possible way, the cartoonish feel of it. It reminded me, I mean, obviously it's a forerunner, it reminded me of Bone in a way, that type of sensibility.
Ooh, that's an interesting contrast.
I was deeply impressed. I mean, I've seen ElfQuest artwork before, obviously, you know, covers and ads and over the years, but this is the first time except for that book we read with Jamie D years ago, that I really sat down and read an ElfQuest story. And I was so impressed with just, I'm assuming they were probably in their 20s at this point, right? However long this is.
Probably.
This is 1978. So yeah.
So, you know, early on, I mean, the stuff is clearly there. And I thoroughly enjoyed this. It's an excellent fantasy story. And I just kept thinking to myself, this hasn't been made into an animated movie yet or a series. I mean, it screams for that.
Just a quick search online says in the early 1990s, an ad for a multi-volume animated adaptation of ElfQuest appeared in the comic. A few issues later, the Peonies told readers they'd withdrawn from the deal. So it looks like it was going to happen at one point, but then didn't and probably never has.
My guess is that in order to sell it, to get the animated version done, they probably had to relinquish quality control and possibly relinquish their rights to sequels or whatever. That maybe made it not as good a deal as it could have been for them.
Yeah.
It's a shame. You know? I could easily see this. Just from the era it came out in the 70s, I could see this in the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings style.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When you think about how this is the time period where Dungeons and Dragons is starting to make its presence felt.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Bakshi, the Hobbit, Lord of the Rings animated films.
Ones, yeah. If you remember, because I had read the books in the late 70s, I read the Lord of the Rings books. I saw the Bakshi version, then I read the books. And the Bakshi version is basically Lord of the Ring, the Fellowship of the Ring, and half of Two Towers. And then what they did was they came up with a Rankin and Bass version of Return of the King, which picked up from where that left off. But the animation was so dramatically different, and you have Orson Bean doing Frodo's voice, and it just didn't hold up.
See, Rankin and Bass, we need our authority Murd here to.
Yep, I was thinking that. Well, and you're probably right. They probably would have had to relinquish too much to do it, because I wonder, because right around that time, of course, Star Wars was hitting from 77 on, and I wonder how much that changed the landscape, because all that merchandising for Star Wars really came out in 78. From that point on, anything fantasy sci-fi, everybody tried to turn into a merchandising juggernaut, and some were successful, some weren't, but I wonder just how many studios and different things said, well, we'll do this, but we're going to need this, because nobody wanted to do what 20th Century Fox did and gave George Lucas all the rights to the merchandising, and thought, nah, he'll never do anything with that, and meanwhile he built an empire from it, literally.
So
the other great thing about the other great thing I was going to say was that, as Shane mentioned, the way they introduce, because there's 17 members of the Holt, as they call it, and they introduce each one, and you get a sense of who they are. Like the narrative is very strong. I mean, it's simple, but by the end of it, you know exactly the place of each of those characters, what their basic personalities are, and what they're going to bring to the group. And the fact that they ended with them like in a desert,
yeah,
which they're not accustomed to at all. You know, makes you want to continue with it. I can imagine readers back then, because I think they said they came out every 4 months.
Oh my gosh.
I think that's what they said in their introduction, something like that. It wasn't monthly. So to wait to see what happens next, I'm sure. And then plus, how did you find the books back then too?
Well, that was what I was saying. That was the whole key to the fact that I had the one store where I knew I could find it.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise the other stores I went to didn't have it.
Yeah, even Marvel and DC, sometimes unless you had one of the early comic shops, you were beholden to the spinner racks. And they weren't always consistent either. So
no, but I had comic shops. I had maybe the comic shops that I went to, and it was still this one niche shop where I was able to get. There were two stores that I regularly frequented at that time, and neither one of them had it. So when I had the excuse to drive over to Bay Ridge, I would always leave about a half an hour early, and I would go to the comic store before I would go and get my mom.
Paul, you're looking pretty good for an old guy.
that's only because you're not as far behind me as I like to think you are. So I just want to mention quickly that I do remember when Byrne took over the Fantastic Four, he aped a scene from ElfQuest when he was dating Frankie Ray, and then he went to pick her up. She was going to watch her roommate who was rehearsing for a play, and the play they were putting on was ElfQuest. I don't know if you guys saw that or if you made the connection.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I have to go back and look at that. Comic.
That's great.
But they talk about, oh, people in my tribe don't do this or whatever. It was right out of ElfQuest.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
I got to say, just quickly by way of rating, I love this book. I'm giving it A's all around. I just think it was great. So I'm going to be quick.
I thought it was great for something, again, I never read like this and got to sink my teeth into the very first original issue. It was a lot of fun to read and very well done, and I could see, if I would have been able to pick this up back then, that I possibly could have been hooked on it too.
Excellent first issue. It does everything a first issue should do.
Yeah.
And the artwork especially. I mean the dialogue is solid, but it's the artwork that really is the star here for me, and that really tells the story and makes you want to continue with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just Wendy Pini is clearly a very talented artist.
Yeah,
and I assume she was not the quickest worker in the world, which is why they would do a 4 month turnaround with books. But
yeah,
I'm surprised she hasn't found her way more into the mainstream over the years. So I guess we'll call an end to this call, and then I'll call you guys back on Skype.
Okay.
And
good luck to all of us.
Hopefully we don't have good luck to all of us, right?
So that does it for ElfQuest. Which one of you gentlemen would like to go next?
Shaney Poo, do you have a preference?
I'll go.
All right, Booster it is.
So this time, and people who are listening can't see it, I'm holding up the most recent iteration in a nice hardback volume.
That's a handsome volume. They came out with
two volumes of Booster Gold's classic series. And it encompasses the entire series, all like, what, 24 issues of it? And what I chose was Booster Gold number 6, because I absolutely love the cover of that issue.
Oh, yeah.
Which gives this great turnaround of Booster Gold and a little bit of his background, like a file, Skeets' picture, the glove, the Legion ring, and guest starring Superman on it. And it's really early in the series. I mean, the series itself had only been out 6 months. This is July of 1986 on the cover, which would have been what, May of 86?
April or May.
April or May.
Yeah.
I did not pick this originally up off the rack. I was really just barely getting into actually collecting DC comics at that time with Justice League, because that came out right. I think their cover date for number one was July. And it wasn't until issue four that Booster Gold came out. And that was the first time I ever heard of Booster Gold. And then after reading Justice League for a little bit, I started to get interested in what this Booster guy Gold guy was. And I started looking into his issues and then got all of his and Blue Beetle's issues. The synopsis for this issue is there's just a young boy on a bike going for like some summer fun. And he passes by this little miniature thing that he thinks at first is a toy, when really it's a little miniature alien. And his
it's a micronaut. Sorry.
Crashed on Earth. He picks it up and it can't communicate very well with him. So he takes it home. And eventually this little micronaut shows that he's looking for Superman by showing this burst of energy in this Superman shield pattern. And this kid sees a commercial for Booster Gold on the TV and decides, hey, maybe I'll go talk to Booster and he'll know what to do because he can help find Superman. He goes to Gold Star Towers, to the business that Booster runs, and talks his way past Trixie into see Booster, shows him the little guy, and Booster decides to help him and puts out a call to news outlets, newspapers, and challenges Superman to come meet him at such and such a date at such and such a time. And Superman's all worried about the threat, because Booster exaggerates, of course, and said, there's a threat coming on Earth, so I dare you to come meet me. So, of course, Superman being Superman, he goes to meet him and is a little bit angry at Booster for the way he portrayed all this. And Booster even kind of sheepishly admits, yeah, you kind of exaggerated, but I needed to get you here. And Booster kind of storms off a little bit frustrated with the situation. And for whatever reason, Skeets tells Superman everything about Booster's origin, every sordid, tawdry detail, his secret identity. I can't remember, and this is really bad of me, I can't remember if in the six issues, if Booster's identity as Michael John Carter was out there in the world, or if he only went by Booster Gold. I'd have to go back and look at the first few issues to kind of remember that, and I didn't. But Skeets goes and tells Superman absolutely everything that's going on. And how Booster got there, which is quite criminal. And it all ends up with another little alien coming and kind of zapping Superman, Booster, and even Skeets in the end. And that's where the issue really ends. It doesn't give you a whole story about what's happening with these little micronauts that are coming through here. I'm sure that comes out later in issue 7 and 8, because 7 you get Superman and Booster battling it out, and the corresponding issue in Superman in a Superman title is Booster Gold beating up Superman. Same cover, just reverse what's happening. But I always love this issue because it's a secret origin issue, even though Booster, God love him, doesn't do it the right way and is kind of criminalistic in his intent, whether his heart's in the right place or not. And Superman's like quite a bit disappointed in a thief becoming a superhero and wanting to be rich as a result of it. But I always loved this series. I mean, everybody who listens to me regularly knows how much I love Booster Gold. And yeah, this series was just fun, and issue 6 was always one of my favorites, and a lot of it had to do with that cover and the secret origin story in the middle of it.
Shane, what was a delight for me was to revisit a comic from the 80s, and this is very much an 80s comic.
Oh, yeah.
In that you have, and I don't mean this as a negative, you have a significant amount of dialogue and captions.
Yeah.
To read. You just got your money's worth out of, I mean, it was 60 cents or 75 cents, whatever it was then, but you got your money's worth, and
even had some thought balloons.
Thought balloons, yes. But
love
what I especially
balloons.
Yeah, and what I especially love, thought balloons are a really missed narrative device. God, Spider-Man wouldn't be Spider-Man without thought balloons. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, I think the Marvel Age of Comics wouldn't be without thought balloons.
Well said. Agreed. Well said.
Agreed.
What I love, though, right from the get-go, is that they establish Skeets as the conscience of Booster Gold.
Yeah.
And early on, like, their comedic repartee is there. And that, to me, that's what's so much enjoyable. I mean, I don't know Booster Gold nearly as well as you do, Shane, but I've always loved the Skeets-Booster dynamic.
Absolutely. You
know, great to see that on display. The other thing that I really enjoyed was somehow we used a vintage credit card from the museum as currency. Yeah. When he went back in time, I guess the account was still open. I don't know what happened there, but
yeah, that may be stretching reality a little bit.
You forget that he grabbed the time machine and came back in time.
You know, I also don't know Booster Gold nearly as well as you. I kind of enjoy it. I've had a theme lately where I come up with these characters who I think highly of. I consider myself a fan of the character, but I don't really know them that well. Mm-hmm. And I would put him in that category. I know him. I got to know him better in the Justice League Unlimited cartoon than anywhere else.
Sure, sure.
But what I got to thinking of is this era when this came out in the mid to late 80s. There was a quarterback on the Baltimore Colts, and that's back when they were the Baltimore Colts.
Yep. Yeah.
His name was Art Schliester. And there was a whole big controversy because from the time that he got drafted for the NFL, he was a heavy, heavy gambler. And before he even got his first paycheck, he had gambled away his signing bonus and hugely in debt. And you know, there was a whole big country. He ended up doing time in jail. I mean, it was serious stuff. But I got to wonder, you know, since that was in the mid-80s, if somehow that influenced this.
Sure.
You know, when this came out, that they said, well, what if, you know, what if in the future somebody had this and he did this? Yeah. I have no idea if
they were thinking about Pete Rose.
Yeah, that could have been too.
No, I don't think the Pete Rose controversy
had hit yet. Okay.
I'm trying to think of when that happened in the, well, this book was 87, Shane?
86.
I think Pete Rose may not have even retired yet. I'm not sure. I think he might have been the player/manager on the Reds.
I remember he was at the end, yeah. I'm not really a sports guy, so I don't know the years, but.
Yeah. I'm a big baseball fan. And my Mets have just let me down hugely this year, but that's besides the point. That's a different podcast for different people.
That's okay for us Philly fans.
Well, you know, I don't think your team is doing what you want either, but they're doing better than mine. So I'll bow before your Philadelphia fanhood.
Oh, you don't have to do that. Oh, gosh. Sometimes they're pretty bad.
Hey, they made it to the World Series last year. It's not so bad. Anyway, I think, you know, you may even be right, Chris, because this may have been when the Pete Rose controversy was first broiling before it really even hit its peak. You know, this, after he left the Phillies. I just find that the whole thought fascinating that somebody would turn that around and become a hero. And that just to make that character the hero of his own book is, you know, kind of the start of almost like a non-edgy anti-hero.
Well, that was captured by the really fun interplay he was having with Superman. Like, Superman's really the blue boy scout in this issue. Like, he's, mm-hmm. you know, how dare you take on the mantle of a hero? You're trying to make a buck out of it. And it was just great to see the two of them going back and forth because they're coming from very different perspectives, obviously.
Early on in the issue, Booster's like all excited to meet Superman.
Oh, yeah.
Really is thinking what an honor it is.
Well, all those years he was the Night Watchman. I mean, he soaked up all this knowledge.
Yeah.
And he obviously was in awe of this time period.
Yep.
So good origin issue, Shane.
It is. I've always liked Dan Jurgens' art.
Oh, yeah.
So. This almost to me, it's almost going to feel like damning him with vain praise because it's to me, it's typical Dan Jurgens, which means it's really good.
Yeah.
You know, and what I one of the things I like about it is it's so easy to distinguish to me the style when he's doing Booster as compared to when he does Superman. Mm-hmm. Superman is just drawn differently. He's more imposing. He's darker. He's more threatening in his own way. And you know, Superman, he's giving the Boy Scout dialogue and yet looking very displeased. It's almost the the paternal displeasure that you're getting out of him.
Yeah.
Well, there's that great panel. I'm sorry. That.
Go ahead, Chris.
Shane
brought me to the point of Superman. When Booster first sees Superman standing above him in like almost like in a godlike posture, and his Booster's looking up at him.
Yeah, well, anybody who grew up, you know, and I know there are people who are exceptions, but anybody who grew up totally respecting their dad and displeased him at one time or another knows that panel from the Booster perspective.
Oh, yes. All my dad had to do was look out his glasses at the top, and you knew you did something wrong.
Exactly. And that's it. When you hit the nail on the head, when I was talking about the paternal displeasure, that's the page I was thinking of.
Yep.
So it's just, I think it's really well captured in here. I like the fact that he has Skeets kind of on the side of each panel the side of each page during the origin, which I usually don't like negative space used in a story, but it's kind of well done in here. So it's just, and it's a totally different type of origin. It's not something, it's not, okay, he was bitten by a radioactive museum artifact.
Yeah, he didn't pick up something and it became his totem or anything like that.
And what I also liked was, I mean, it's not as probably edgy as it would be now, but, they established that he destroyed his life. Like his family threw him out. Because he was involved in shady activity, and they show you, at least to a degree, the cost of that, and how he ruined himself and his mother and his sister.
So
Shane, I assume they go into that more in other stories down the road.
They do, and they end up, not to spoil too much for anybody else, but they do retcon that a little bit down the road to be, if I'm not mistaken, that he's betting on these games to help his father in some way. So he's trying to make money for that and take care of his mom, too. He does have some adventures with his sister. She ends up coming back. It's short-lived, but she's around for a little bit. They really take, and I mean, and think about this. This is the mid 80s, so this is the decade of greed and Wall Street and all that. So having a self-centered, egotistical superhero who's out to make a buck, even though he's in some ways and really later years really does do it for the right intentions, at this time it's really his greed while still trying to be a hero. That's very conflicting. And hard to get past at times because he really comes across as a real ass.
But that's always what I think compelling about the character is that you have mixed feelings about him because ultimately he usually ends up doing the right thing.
Oh, yeah.
His reasons for often doing the right thing, though, aren't necessarily the most noble or heroic. They're often very human or very sordid. That's also – plus you always have Skeets there going like, okay, well, wait a minute. Why are we doing this? Like,
Jiminy Cricket.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know later as Booster's story pans out into Justice League and he befriends Ted Kord as Blue Beetle and they go on adventures, Ted's just another voice of reason for him to bounce off of. And they really do. I love this series is only 24 issues, but then there's the second series that comes out after or before Infinite Crisis. Boy, I can't remember. I think it's after. And it's really Booster being a hero without anybody ever knowing it because he can't let them know it. And if they know it, that's going to screw up all kinds of stuff in time.
Oh, that's the one.
That wasn't New 52, was it?
No, it was before that.
Okay.
I do remember reading the 2000s, I think.
Yeah, it was in the 2000s.
I read that series. It was thoroughly entertaining. I really enjoyed
it. What they did was they gave him the origin of a supervillain.
Yeah.
His
really is.
Power set and everything is created through avarice. It's not created for noble means. And he has basically a supervillain origin, and then they somehow turn that around to make him into a hero, which is it's atypical. It's just not something that was done. And I think it's exceedingly clever.
I really think throughout all of Booster Gold's history, I think Batman's one of the few that actually knows his true purpose as they progress his stories in the 2000s. And of course, Skeets, and maybe a choice few others, but it's not many. Most people think he's just an arrogant dipstick who really is just trying to make a buck out of everything he does. But I always love the character, and I love that they bring in Skeets to be the Jiminy Cricket, and later in other stories, Blue Beetle helps out with that too. And it's just it's just always been a character that I've enjoyed from the first time I read him in Justice League number 4 through today.
And you top it off with the fact that they sandwiched this origin in and gave us just enough story that you want to read the next one.
Yeah.
Not for more origin, but for where does this story go?
Yeah.
Very, very well done.
Now, it's captivating and fun. And vintage 80s, as Chris said, too. It's absolute true 80s through and through.
For people listening in, I'm going to pull back the curtain and for a second. Shane was on the fence between this and a different Booster Gold issue. And I'm not going to say which one that was, because I think if we can find another time to record, I'm going to ask you to bring that one, because I think that one would go good as a bookend with this one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That sounds great.
So Shane came up with the choice of two, and Chris picked which one we were doing.
Yeah.
And good choice, both of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to go again and say, for me, A's down the line on this one. It's just an excellent book.
Yeah. This is another one that I have an original issue. I have a trade paperback. I have this hardback. This is another one I've got like 1,000 different versions of the same few issues.
And what's so strong about the origin is that, and Shane gave an example just before, is that there's so much room to work with that and to further develop that character and the world he came from. You know, sometimes some of these origins, you know, they can be kind of, they don't hold up over time, but or time, as Murd might say. But
yeah.
I think this is a strong origin, because, you know, like you guys said, the fact that he's a very, in some ways, a more sordid character. And obviously, when you ever have an anti-hero type figure, that's always such a great narrative device. So are we all rating, Paul, or did you just do that? I forgot.
No, it's up to everybody to rate as much as you want.
All A's. It's
Oh, yeah. All A's for me, too.
And I love those 80s colors.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
As well.
Well, and this, you know,
I could easily see this character drawn by Steve Ditko.
Oh, like, sure.
It in kind of the, you know, the 60s Charlton line.
Good call.
To Blue Beetle, where he could have been.
Good call, Paul. Good call.
This hardback version is beautiful. It was a little pricey, but of course I ordered it from DCBS, so it was $20. It smells great. It's made of great paper. It looks great. It feels great. It's not that newer shiny stuff. It's just a fabulous trade dress.
And that's the two volume. You said?
It's two volumes. It encompasses the whole series. The dust jacket comes off to reveal kind of the same picture, but a little bit more fanfare and glit behind it. And
I love the back copy. He's in it for the bucks.
Yeah. He's in it for the bucks.
Gordon Gekko of superheroes.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's the era. That's the same era that this was happening in.
Yep.
You know, it was the Reagan years, Gordon Gekko.
God, I love the 80s. And not because I was greedy. I just love the 80s. I listen to 80s music yet. God, if I had some of the clothes, I'd still wear them.
Now, Shane, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. I mean,
no, I love the 80s.
Yeah, I'm a little older than you, so I'm more into the 70s and the 70s music, but I ain't wearing none of those 70s clothes. So, all right, so let's keep moving along. And Chris, I got to tell you, if I had to bet, I would have bet significant money that in light of the recent news that we've had, that you were going to pick a book drawn by John Romita Sr.
Oh,
I was a little surprised by your choice. I'm not complaining about your choice at all, but no. I'm a little surprised because I just thought that's where you'd go.
That's a good point.
But you always, every time you've been on here, I think you've surprised me a little bit with what you've chosen, and it's never let me down.
Oh,
and I'm gonna start off by putting this in front of you.
Oh,
my Mike Plug, Modern Masters volume from Tomorrows, and maybe that's the first clue of what you picked.
Yeah.
Well, Let me hold up on the screen. Unfortunately, the listeners can't see this. One of the reasons why I picked this book, because it has a special place in my heart.
I was going to ask. I was very curious.
Here's the original. There we go. There's the power record.
That makes sense. Okay. Yep.
I did not have that power record.
So. No, I did not have that power record. I couldn't figure out. I was reading, and I'm like, nothing. It's not a bad story by any means, but I'm like, there's nothing really special happening. Like, it's not a surprise at the end or anything. And I'm like, why did Chris pick this book of all the books he could have picked?
Well, for those listening at home, we're talking about Man-Thing Issue 5. Volume 1, very much the Bronze Age, ladies and gentlemen, 1974. Oh, yeah. And Shane, I picked this for a couple of reasons. One was the nostalgic affection I have for the Power Records of my youth, which apparently were produced because I looked in the record copyright in Newark, New Jersey.
Wow.
Which makes sense considering some of the accents you got on some of these recordings. it's a man wolf! Anyway, number two, I'm such a lover of the Bronze Age Marvel horror titles, and this story in particular, I think the main reason I chose it, Shane, because you're right, not a ton happens in the issue, but it's Steve Gerber writing, Mike Plug penciling, and the narrative tone in the book is very in keeping with, I think, was the progression of Marvel in the 70s, where you had stories that were even more personal in their tone, in the dialogue, in the caption boxes. And as both as a younger reader and now, it still strikes me how human this type of story is. And the way Gerber captures, really in just brief strokes, even maybe just a caption box, a particular character, a particular situation. Stanley got the ball rolling with this type of storytelling. But people like Gerber, Jerry Conway, Steve Englehart, Jim Starlin, they took it to the next level. And
see,
I think
I'm going to say that Steve Englehart and Jerry Conway and Len Wein and other guys like that, Roy Thomas even, kind of took what Stan did and continued it and fleshed it out a little bit. Steve Gerber was a unique animal, though. He did not march to the beat of any other drummer.
No, he was.
I love his stuff, and I do have the fond memory of meeting him at a Comic-Con in the 70s at one point. And
wow,
you know, even though I was a punk teenager and he was probably in his 20s, he spent time. He talked to me and my friends, and was very, very cool. So I have a warm spot for every one of the writers I just mentioned, but I definitely have a personal nostalgia when you mention Steve Gerber.
Well, I mean, Gerber, when you think, of course, Howard the Duck. Sure. I mean, this story, I think, and I don't mean this as a put-down, is kind of tame in many ways compared to some other Gerber work. The other reason I chose it is that Mike Plug is one of the great artists of the 1970s in comics. And he was an apprentice to Will Eisner, and you could tell that in his penciling style. Or he worked in Eisner's studio. I don't remember the exact capacity, but he worked with Eisner for a period of time. And the way Plug draws, you know, horror creatures, monsters, you know, the swamp, there's just a sensibility to it that as a kid struck me so profoundly. His work on Ghost Rider, Werewolf by Night, Frankenstein's Monster. I mean, he did all these titles. He co-created Ghost Rider, the modern Ghost Rider. And then, of course, I first experienced him on this Man-Thing story, initially in the Power Record, and then eventually I found the comic version. But what strikes me is the book is beautifully rendered. The art, I think, is breathtaking. And he brings a human quality to this shambling muck monster that is not human at all. And that's always struck me. Do you want me to do a plot synopsis first?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as brief or as rambling as you would like.
I'll try to be as coherent as I can. So basically, the story starts with a very powerful and stunning opening page where the man thing, you know, he emerges from the swamp. And it's a very Eisner-esque title page where they incorporate the title into the art. It's stunning. And you then, and this is another reason why I wanted to pick this book. And they actually included this in the Power Record. It's so 70s in that they show a character committing suicide in the comic, which, and then they made a record for kids and they kept that scene in the Power Record. The 70s, man. Ah, just incredible. So.
And this is with the Comics Code Authority.
Yes. And the Comics Code Authority. It's on the cover. You're right, Paul. Remember, they had liberalized the code at this point, which is why they actually could have horror comics at Marvel. Yes, we won't get into the whole giant size man thing crack. It's just there. It's obvious. So in the story, this random circus clown drives, to the perimeter of the swamp, sits down right off the road and shoots himself. And what's always gripping about Gerber's Man Thing run is that, and again, we don't see this anymore, it's a style of writing that's basically gone in comics, is that it's very heavy on captions. And because the Man Thing can't actually verbalize and communicate, everything's is in the mind of the Man Thing, such as it is. And to me, that's what makes the story so entrancing, because it's the Man Thing trying to balance the fact that he once was a man, Ted Salas. He has some scraps of memory of when he was a human being, and then trying to accommodate that to what the experience he's having now. The book does a nice job in a two-page spread of giving you a quick sort of the memories of Ted Salas as the scientist, the soldier, etc. The Man Thing, somewhere deep in the recesses of his mind, realizes I must bury this being who's dead. And then we go to the Richard Rory character, who, as Mervyn says, like the Rick Jones of the Man Thing universe. And again, the 70s clothes here are amazing. The headbands, the huge belt buckles. I'm just loving every second of it. And he and his companion Ruth Hart are on the road. And again, this story is the middle of the thing. So you realize that they had encountered the Man Thing before. This is in Florida, of course. And I love how Gerber brings a little bit of the culture war into this story, how the crotchety ancient motel owner will not let him and Ruth sleep in the same room together, and they have to pick separate beds. Did you guys catch that?
Yeah. I wondered. I'm like, that's weird, but it makes sense for the time.
Yeah. And
I
she says,
code authority.
She says, well, that was a hassle, wasn't it, Joe College? And he says, I hate people who make education sound like a dirty word. I bet he's a reform school reject. God, Gerber was so good. Like, just, I mean, he just captures the scene and captures characters so well, these quick broad strokes. Then we get into the circuses in town, and there's a circus performer, a woman is being beaten up by the owner. Richard intervenes. Then you have the strong man with the great name Trag, T-R-A-G-G, and then they run off with the girl just to protect her. And then they see the clown apparently alive by the side of the swamp, posing in a supernatural spotlight that appears from nowhere. Trag and the clip head of the circus are hunting the trapeze artist who's fled, the tightrope artist. The clown, or is it a ghost or what have you, causes their truck to crash. Trag survives. He falls into the swamp. Meanwhile, the Richard, Ruth, and the other girl are looking for the clown. They see the Man Thing carrying the clown. They think the Man Thing has killed the clown. Richard, sort of wards it. Shouts and the Man Thing shambles off, and they realize that he's been shot, and then Trag shows up to fight him, to attack them. The Man Thing reappears. Now, because Trag isn't afraid, he doesn't burn at the Man Thing's touch, which is his supernatural power, which they note in the captions. And the Man Thing is just wiping the swamp with Trag, and then he starts to drown him, but then he relents. The last vestige of humanity reminds him not to kill. And then this is a two-parter. So at the very end, the spirit of the clown manifests itself. It's great Plug artwork, very creepy, and rises up from the body, and then boom, end issue. And then I can tell you in issue 6, they continue with the story. So I chose this for all the reasons I mentioned. This to me is just vintage, early 70s Marvel at its best in terms of very personal story, magnificent artwork, great narrative voice. You got your money's worth for 25 cents back then, folks. So,
yeah, it's. I as I said, I always respect Gerber's stories, which are just far out. you know, they, I mean, they are always just a little on edge and clearly a little influenced by whatever it is he was imbibing at the time. But the thing about this issue that really makes it stand out to me as a top issue is the Plug art. I've always loved the Plug art. Plug to me, I mean, I know you mentioned that he worked in Will Eisner's studio, but it feels to me like he should have worked with Bernie Wrightson. It feels like it's a brother from another mother with Bernie Wrightson as far as the artwork style that he did, because he was made for horror, just like Wrightson was. And I remember in this era, this is around the era when I first started buying comics as a collector. There's this, you know, on the bullpen page where they list the issues that came out that month. I remember that month well. This is like the infancy of my being a collector, and I just, you know, it all stands out to me. And I remember when I was in grade school around this time, I wrote a book report about comics, and I made the distinction between the Golden Age, the Bronze Age, and now the current age, which was still actually the Bronze Age anyway, and the Silver Age and all of that. And I had to put a cover on it. So I drew a picture of the Man-Thing, because the Man-Thing is kind of an amorphous being. And it was easy for somebody who doesn't have much in the way of training to draw. But when you look at this book and you look at the way that Plug rendered him, there isn't just wild pencil lines going all over the place. All of the lines have a purpose. And much like the panel of Superman that we discussed in the last issue, in this one on page that's numbered as 23, in the bottom right corner, there's a shot of the Man-Thing engulfed in shadows, and usually the shadows make it easier because you don't have to put much detail into it, but it's so creepy looking that I just think it's gorgeous.
Good pick for that panel. Yep.
Every shot, though, that he has of the Man-Thing, that, like I said, there's purpose in every line. It's not just muck the way that I drew it as a whatever I was, 10, 11-year-old at this time, because it was easy to draw that. This is an easy character in the hands of a master is what it comes down to. And he shows you the difference between what a master would do with this character and what a regular run-of-the-mill artist might do. The interesting thing is I don't love Plug on regular people as much. I love him on the monsters. I love him on the creepy. I love him on, you know, all of that. But when it comes down to like a regular scene, like if he has to do a scene in like an office building, I don't think I would love it at all. I think you need the horror for him. And I wonder, I'm sure there is an example of it. I'm sure there's a Ghost Rider issue with guest stars or something along those lines, or a Werewolf by Night issue with guest stars where he drew regular superheroes. But I'm curious to see what that would look like right now, because I can't picture it offhand.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, Paul. I can't think of – I'm sure it's out there, but I can't, there's no images coming to my head of Plug drawing, you know, the sort of, let's call them the main Marvel heroes. You know, he was on all the monster books, and thankfully, because they're amazing. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
But you're right.
I'm just paging through my Plug Tomorrow's book, and I see, you know, he did some Planet of the Apes.
That's right. Oh well, those
he was well suited for that as well.
That's the black and white magazines he did with Doug Monk. Those are phenomenal.
Oh, they'd be great. Yeah. I can't imagine they wouldn't be beautiful.
Yep.
I'm not much of a horror comic fan. I would have never on my own picked this up in a million years, let alone when I was younger. But I got to say, the artwork is just outstanding. I would not initially have thought about Will Eisner, but as soon as you said it, there's the page early on in the story where you have a real close-up on the clown's face just before he pulls the trigger.
And
I can see it right in there, the Will Eisner side of it.
Good call, Shane.
It's just fantastic. Just page after page, just beautiful. And I agree. Sometimes his human facial features aren't the best, but every other piece of art around it, and including Man-Thing himself, just makes up for it in spades.
And that's not to say that the human characters look bad.
No,
they just don't. They just don't stand out the way the other characters do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think out of all the human characters, the clown, of course, is great. But the clown himself is a little bit abstract in the way he is,
yep,
just for being, especially one that's suicidal. So it's it was a fun story to read. I knew almost nothing about it. The closest I ever came to reading anything about Man-Thing was watching that Halloween special on Disney
Plus. I was going to bring that up. Yep.
A few months ago, which was fantastic.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, this was a treat for the eyes and everything. But boy, oh boy, just beautiful artwork.
I'm glad you fellas enjoyed it.
you have yet to let me down on the choices you've made from Prez to Black Panther to, I'm trying to think of what other ones you've brought over the years, but you've always picked a winner. So I would have been surprised if you didn't. What's the strong guy's name? Trag.
Yep.
He's another one because he's drawn almost as a horror character.
Yes,
sure. Yeah.
So he's also very well rendered. You know, giving him his own kind of circus of crime to draw makes it easier to fit in with the Ploog style as well, because it's not, you know, they're not your run of the mill. Again, it's not an office scene. It's, you know, it's strange characters in a strange background, which, you know, is fitting.
Well, the page on page 17, when the pickup truck crashes, look at the second panel where the two men in the cab of the truck, their faces are illuminated by the light. It's gripping artwork. There's a supernatural sheen to almost everything that's going on in this story. It's, man. Yeah.
And when I look at the artwork in these stories, a lot of times what I try to do is I try to go back to the beginning again and avoid reading any dialogue or captions and just look at the artwork and bring myself through the story with the artwork, because that's how I judge the storytelling. It's as I'm doing that, is the story progressing based purely on the artwork, and am I seeing where it's going and understanding it? Now, that's not to say dialogue and captions aren't necessary in a book, because I do think they add a lot to it. Don't get me wrong. But I think storytelling is, in many cases with many modern artists, it's a little bit of a lost art. Mm-hmm. I think some artists have gotten too into the, I'm going to draw a poster image, and I'm going to draw a lot of splash pages, and they really aren't bringing stories along with their artwork. They're letting the dialogue do that for them. And that's a little lazy as far as I'm concerned. And it definitely does not fit with the Marvel method. I think that's one of the areas where, you know, people blast Stan for like, oh, you took credit, but you had the artists do this. Stan created a method where he forced these artists to put together stories that had storytelling in the artwork.
Yep. I mean, yeah, we can separate that from the, you know, the creator controversy, which is a whole other issue. But from an artistic standpoint, the method itself, I mean, brought out, I would argue, the best of these artists. I mean, because they were compelled to plot as well as draw, and you know, they were all master storytellers. And I don't know if Gerber used the Marvel method or not. I can't answer that. But like you said, Paul, like Ploog knows how to tell a story. Like the opening page is amazing. The introduction of the man thing in the issue. And in the Power Record, because the Power Record was my first experience with the character, you know, they use that exact same page. I mean, in the Power Records, I'm sure you guys know, they would take out some of the more sophisticated caption and dialogue and then substitute more simplified stuff. But the essence of the story, including the clown shooting himself, is still there. So
one of my favorites is towards the end when the clown, when his ghost comes out and he starts to ascend. That those are all very well rendered and striking images as well.
And he has a skeletal visage. His face is more like a skeleton. Yeah. In the
but he's posed almost like P.T. Barnum.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
He's addressing his audience. So I think it's very, very cool.
Yeah, just a fascinating issue.
It's amazing that they chose this as a Power Records. Now, I had the Power Records issues for Spider-Man, Captain America, the Fantastic Four, and the Hulk. Those are the ones that I had. So they were all the mainstream heroes. I didn't have any of these. I'm sorry?
I don't think I had many, maybe one or two.
The beauty is now you can listen to them anytime you want on YouTube because everybody has posted them on there with images.
That's great. Awesome. I had most of them, Paul, all the ones you mentioned, but I was lucky enough to have most of the horror ones too, which like they did Manhunt, they did Tomb of Dracula. They did Werewolf by Night. I think they did Frankenstein too, if I remember correctly. I think they did.
And were they multi-actor or was it one guy reading and changing?
No, they were multi-actor. They had the same actors in every book.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
I think like in the Spider-Man one, the one who does Peter Parker's voice is the one who does Rick Jones's voice in the Hulk issue.
That makes sense. Well, they probably recorded them all in an afternoon, Paul. So, you know, come on.
Probably.
I mean, I'm looking at my, right? So 45 RPM.
Nice.
Power Records, Newark, New Jersey. Copyright 1974. So
awesome.
Yeah, I was two.
I was one.
Yeah.
I was of age to be listening to it. Well, I was born in 62, so.
Okay. Oh, so you're a whole 10 years older than me. That's not bad.
Does it make you feel young?
Yeah, no.
That's why I'm here.
My body tells me no.
Well, somewhere up in my brain, I'm still about 14 years old, but physically I'm falling apart.
That's me too. I'm definitely still stuck in my teenage years for a lot of things. And you know, I'd probably do myself well to just turn off every electronic device and TV in the world and just go back to reading comics all the time like I did when I was a kid.
Ah, Shane, you can balance the exuberance of youth with the wisdom of age. So,
yeah, I get lazy and tired, just turn on the TV. I shouldn't.
Oh, there's you know what? There's so much good stuff to be had on the TV.
There is,
too, though.
There is. And a lot of it's superhero related.
Yeah.
And the danger of that. Let's go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
I was going to say it's really just a battle to balance all your aspects of your life, the different things you want for entertainment, the things you need to do for your spouse and your children and any other family that you have and your friends and your job. What life has taught me is maturity means finding a way to balance all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more because what I found especially with like you guys said, there's so much to choose now on television, the streaming platforms. I start to feel like I'm watching too much stuff. There's other things I should be doing with my time. Mm-hmm. So then you have to, like you said, you have to be mature and select. All right, what shows am I going to watch? What am I just going to like? Oh, you know what? I'm just going to let that one go because it's another hour I could be doing something else. So
yeah.
So, but it's nice to have these choices.
Yes, and it's nice to be able to have friends that I can invite onto the show and just have a good time for an hour and a half, 2 hours, just shooting the breeze about stuff that we all love. So I'm going to take this opportunity to once again thank you guys for coming on and tell you I couldn't enjoy it more than I do.
Paul, it was our pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having us. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So if anybody's listening and doesn't know where you could find these guys, I think if you look up Comic Geek Speak, you'll be able to find them. So
we're there
indeed.
But thanks again, guys. And thank you, everybody who tuned in to listen. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to our show. And we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.